Okay, let's get this started. If Corinth were a cake, the internet, you may have noticed that the internet has given a new forum for people who like to brag and people who like to show off. It's also given them a new forum for people who are really creative and want to get that stuff out. And so I don't know if you've heard of a little site called Pinterest. I'm sure many of you have been on there. Pinterest has become this amazing thing where you can go and see all the things that you wish you could do and you really can't. And this morning I want to draw a metaphor from Pinterest. So the first picture that you will see up on the screen is this is something that someone had hoped to bake for, you know, probably their kid the next, you know, Saturday morning. It's family time and they're going, yeah, let's have some pancakes and let's make it look, you know, artistic. Let's make it look really cool. Well, the next slide is the result. That's what actually happened. You know, I don't know, maybe you feel that way when you make these kinds of things and you make that attempt too. The next one is actually my favorite. The next one is a cake that someone has made probably for their kid for a birthday. It's a little minion from the movie Despicable Me. And so that was what they were attempting to make. And the next one, that is the result. All right? What I want to use that picture to illustrate is that I think that something has gone wrong with the church in Corinth, and they're getting something like this as the result of what's going on. We have been talking about how this church has a whole lot of really good things happening in the church, but they're happening in such a way that it's actually gotten pretty ugly. It's become sort of like that picture up there. And Paul is addressing a group of people who have a lot of good things going for them, and somehow it's gone wrong. And the chapter that we're going to talk about today is addressing that exact problem. So just to recap, okay, we've been talking about how there has been a lot of bickering, there have been a lot of divisions and fighting that has been happening in this church. We talked about that, especially around chapters 1 to 4. But chapter 6, which we didn't touch on, no, we could not touch on everything in this book. Yes, I'm looking at you. We couldn't touch on everything, but one of the things that we didn't touch on is that they're suing one another. Some of them are taking each other to court. There's a lot of division that's happening in this church. And then we talked about just a couple of weeks ago, what's happening at the Lord's Supper. The Lord's Supper, they have a meal together. It isn't just what we do here, little shot glasses afterwards. They have a meal together. They get together, but instead of doing sort of potluck, they're bringing their own food, and then they're not sharing it with people who don't have anything. It's creating insiders and outsiders. And they're using that meal as a way of putting down other people. So the poor people who are coming into this church are not being fed, and they're watching rich people eat lobster and eat veal and drink Merlot, and they're getting stale bread and they're getting water. Okay, that's what's happening in this church. It's creating huge divisions. It's creating huge problems as a result. It would be a little bit like if someone invited you over to their house for a meal, and you show up, you're 15 minutes early, you figure you'll get there a little bit early, and you'll enjoy one another's company before the meal is served. You knock on the door, and you hear someone say, come on in, come on in. So you open the door, and your host has started without you. They started the meal without you. That's what they're doing in this church, too. They're not even waiting for everyone to join them for the meal. So your host has started the meal without you, and then you walk in, and you're like, oh, man, that smells really good. It's the meal I've been waiting for. It's veal, or it's lobster, or it's something great, and you see there's a bottle of wine on the table. And they hand you a bowl of microwave Kraft dinner. That is what is happening in this church, okay? That's what's going on. That's the way that the people in the pews here are treating one another. And that's what Paul is addressing here. They're actually making a mockery of the people who have less as a result. it would, to draw a different analogy, it'd be a little bit like if you pull into the parking lot and you have a Beamer, and then you walk into church and you meet someone who just got off the bus, and you actually mocked them for taking the bus to church. I mean, that's the level of bitterness and hostility that this church has for one another. It's frightening. That's the way that they're treating one another. And then when they actually come into this space and they start worshiping together, they've turned it into American Idol with their spiritual gifts. Rob started to talk about that last week, and he's going to pick it up again in a couple of weeks. They're taking their gift of tongues and they're showing off in contrast to what they're supposed to be doing with their spiritual gifts, which Rob touched on last week. Chapter 12, verse 7 says that God has given gifts to his people for the building up of the body, for the common good. But they are taking their spiritual gifts and they're making sure that they feel really good about what they are doing. And they're showing off, they're all doing this blah, 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 tongues thing going on. And they're not in any way building up anyone else. And it's actually become a barrier to those who would come into this church because it's just chaos. It's self-aggrandizement. They're focusing on themselves. They're not focusing on the people that are around them. So that's chapter 12 and chapter 14. And then right smack dab in the middle of chapter 12 and 14, which are all about the chaos that's going on in these spiritual gifts, Rob says, and now, Paul says, and now for something completely different, I'm going to give you a wedding homily. Like, seriously, is that what you think is going on in this passage? Chapter 13, all about love. Paul's like, yeah, I wrote this stuff for a wedding. It has nothing to do with spiritual gifts or your life in the church or anything like that, but I just thought I'd throw it smack dab in the middle of there. Is that what's going on? No. Scripture needs to be read in context, historical context and literary context. Very, very, very important. And when you read it in context, it takes these amazing words of chapter 13, which all of you, I know, love. I mean, it's just an incredible passage, and it just makes it even more amazing. It makes it even more incredible, even more profound when you actually understand what Paul is saying to this group of people who can't get along with one another. I think that the context really does deepen the meaning, because Paul, when he says love is patient and love is kind, Paul isn't just waxing eloquent. He isn't being abstract. He's not just praising love. He's talking to a group of people who aren't patient and who aren't kind with one another, and he's addressing them, these people who are focusing too much on themselves. That's what Paul's doing. So Paul is not speaking to two people at the front of a church who are about to say their vows to one another. That could certainly be applied there. I mean, it's a beautiful passage. Of course you can do that. But Paul is addressing actually people who don't get along with one another. Now, the people at the church at some point won't get along with one another, right? None of you laughed at that. Haven't you not been married? You all get along all the time? What the heck? Yeah, no, Paul is addressing people who are, in the moment, not getting along. He's addressing this giant Pinterest failure of a church. That is a metaphor of what is happening here at this church. They got a lot of good things in the recipe, and something went really, really wrong, and it's gotten ugly. So please hear it with that in mind. So let me read the beginning of this passage again. If I speak in the tongues of mortals and angels, but I do not have love, I'm a noisy gong. I'm just a clanging cymbal. If I have prophetic powers and I understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have faith so as to remove mountains, but I don't have love, like I'm nothing. If I give away all my possessions, if I hand over my body so that I may boast, but I don't have love, I gain nothing. Now again, think back to last week and what Rob said when he was talking about spiritual gifts. He said that they are intended to build up the body. Your gift is actually for the sake of the other people in this room right now. That's what Rob was getting at. That's what Paul is getting at in this passage. He says that the gifts are given for the common good. So when these people are falling in love with the fact that they speak in tongues and they sound really, really eloquent, you know, it makes them sound like angels or something like that. It makes them feel really, really good. They've lost the point. They've missed the point. And they're not noticing that their behavior is deeply selfish. It's not building others up at all. It's chaotic. It's not worshipful. And it's become a barrier to the people who are coming into this community. Now, Paul says, tongues are good. You should use tongues, but only in love. That's what Paul's getting at. And the same goes for every good gift that he lists. Prophecy, speaking a word of knowledge, speaking about, you know, giving deep teachings. You know, any good gift that you have or I have or any good deed that we do, if it's not done in love, like it's worthless, is what Paul's saying. What I'd like to do for this section and then the next section as well is, because these words are so familiar, what I'd like to do is paraphrase it for you. So hear this passage again in sort of a paraphrase. If I speak in the eloquent words of men and angels, but I don't have love, I've become irritating, incomprehensible. If I have the gift of saying the right word at the right time, if I have the ability to understand the deep teachings and I can expound the mysteries of the word, if I have Herculean faith that can topple mountains, if I've got all that, but I don't have love for others, I'm worthless. If I liquidate my assets and send it to refugees and starving children, and then I wear out my body working for God, if I don't have love, I'm no further ahead with God than a narcissist or a terrorist or even an atheist. Now, I'm not denigrating atheists when I put that up there. I'm simply saying that we're no further ahead with God if we don't act in love than someone who doesn't even believe in God, right? But we are no further ahead with God if we teach scripture, we lead a Bible study, if we sing up here on the stage, if we give our money away, if we tithe, if we go serve over at Normando, work in their breakfast program, or read to kids. Anything that we do, it doesn't advantage us anything with God if there isn't love as the motivation behind it. That's what Paul is getting at here. But the reverse is also true. The things that are done with love really do seem to get us further ahead with God. You know, Jesus actually spoke quite a bit about rewards, didn't he? Jesus spoke quite a number of times about rewards. And I think that if we are acting in love and if we are doing these things, that seems to be the thing that's going to advantage us with God, that we will get a reward for it. But if we don't, if there's no love involved, like there's no brownie points that we get with God for being honest about on our taxes or for driving the speed limit, right? Life without love does not advantage us at all. But life with love, there seems to be great reward with that. And that's what this next section is all about. So hear it again. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. It bears all things. It believes all things and hopes all things and endures all things. One of the first things that I noticed when I was actually studying this passage was that Paul didn't mention emotions anywhere. Apparently, love was a little bit more than sort of something warm and fuzzy and fluttery, you know, in here. So I would really caution us about having really a steady diet of media that actually portrays love solely in those terms. We might want to be really, really careful about that. Paul is by no means being exhaustive here in this passage. This isn't everything that could be said about love. But the fact that he doesn't mention emotions, I think that that's worth saying at the same time. And I mention it because I made that mistake as a teenager. I made that mistake when Chantal and I had been dating for a couple of years. We dated for about 2 years. And then we got to a point where there were a number of different things going on. But one of the reasons that we broke up 2 years into it was that I really misunderstood what love was. And I thought it was that really, you know, the fluttery heart. And, you get really, really excited when you're spending time with them and you get to hold hands or something like that. But that does fade after a while, right? You know that. The 500th time you hold hands with your beloved is not nearly as exciting as that first time, right? And I misunderstood what that meant. So I do just want to caution us a little bit about the importance that we place on the emotional side of love. There is certainly emotion that goes with love, but there is certainly a lot more to it as well. What I do want to point out directly from this passage is that love is not abstract. Paul is talking here about what love looks like in action. If you read love is patient and kind are adjectives if you speak grammar, and it can be a little bit abstract when you read it like that. But actually, in the Greek, the reason that we have to render it in English as patient and kind is because we don't have verbs for these things in English. But these are verbs in Greek. So Paul is saying, love kindnesses people. Love patiences others. We can't say that in English. It sounds really awkward. But Paul is getting at something that this is not an abstract thing. Love is not just, I could be patient, or I could be kind. Love shows this kind of thing. It is a demonstration that Paul is getting at. So love is kind, sure. But love shows kindness. Love shows patience. Paul is getting at the way that these people are acting with one another. He doesn't give two hoots about how they feel about one another. He wants to know how that's being put into practice in the life of this body. Paul is addressing a church, right? He's doing sort of what I'm doing. He wrote a letter. Someone would have stood up in front of the congregation and read out that letter and then explained it. He is addressing us, right? Not so much the couple at the front of the church. He's addressing the people who can't get along but really do need to. So Paul isn't sort of writing a sonnet about love. He's writing about our interactions. He's writing about your small group and our missional community and this corporate gathering. That's what Paul's getting at. So let me paraphrase this section for you again. Before I do, I did miss one thing. When it says that love is patient, it's a little bit more than just love can wait for a little bit, for a little while. The Greek has to do with long suffering, that love can actually bear up under the pain and the weight of something really difficult for the sake of someone else. So when I paraphrase, let me put that into sort of different words for you. Love suffers as long as it takes for the other person. Love is a lifestyle of kindness. Love doesn't think about itself. It isn't self-absorbed. It doesn't praise itself. It isn't shady or dodgy. It doesn't pursue its own interests. It doesn't delight in being ornery. It doesn't bank resentment. It doesn't celebrate sin. Love is best friends with the truth. Love keeps secrets. Love has confidence in God and keeps hope and endurance the priority. I don't know about you, but when I read Paul's words in this passage, I think there are probably two or three different reactions that are probably happening in this room in different individuals. One is probably just, yes, like let's celebrate this. Love is absolutely incredible. This is a beautiful passage. This is exactly what our church needs. This is what our world needs. Yes. And that should happen. We should be in awe of what is going on here and what Paul is describing. I think another reaction, a reaction I really had to work through this week, is when I read these words, I feel deeply inadequate. I don't know about you, but I don't really measure up to what Paul is talking about here. I don't, maybe you do. If you do, I'd really like to get to know you. But you know what, I read that passage and it's very, very hard for me to put Ben is patient and Ben is kind and so on, going through that. I don't know if you can do it. It's pretty hard. It's something that we can't really measure up to very well. I think there's a third reaction as well, and this one definitely needs to take place. How does Paul know this about love? I think Paul knows this about love because he has spent years and years getting to know God. Getting to know God in prayer and getting to know God as he is revealed in Scripture. He would have only had the Old Testament, right? And getting to know God that he is experiencing presently through his Spirit, the God who is Christ. And that's how he knows what love is about. Because God is patient and God is kind. God suffers as long as it takes for that other person. God has a lifestyle of kindness. God doesn't think about himself. God isn't self-absorbed. God isn't shady or dodgy, and so on. I think all three of those readings probably need to take place if we're going to understand this passage and if we're going to get it into our own bloodstreams. The primary commentary that Rob and I are using for this series is a really thick one by a guy named Gordon Fee. And I, in addition to his commentary, I also have his audio, some of the lectures that he was giving to a class about 1 Corinthians. And I was listening this week to 1 Corinthians 13, and he said that while he was writing the commentary, he was suddenly struck by the thought, what if God weren't like this? Like, it just hit him. Can you imagine? What would life be like if God were not like this? He said, the only hope that you and I have is that God is like this. We're hooped without it. This is what God is like. And because God is like this, there is hope for me and for you and for us to become like him. That is the only hope that we have for actually becoming the kind of loving person that this passage describes. I do have to clarify one thing about love, and it relates to this passage, because this passage is set in the broader context of spiritual gifts, but love is not a gift. Love is not something that Joel might have and I might not, because God has distributed different gifts to people, just like Jen has a gift for administration, and Shane has a gift for music, and someone else has the gift of teaching, and so on and so on. You know, he's talking about tongues and prophecy and so on. He talks about all these different spiritual gifts, right? But love is not one of those gifts, okay? Love is not something that one person might have and another person might not. Where does love come from? You have to think of Galatians for that. Love is a fruit of the Spirit. It's not a gift of the Spirit. So please understand that. The only hope that you and I have of becoming a loving person is because God is like that, and he has put his Spirit in us. And he will bear that fruit in our lives. Love comes from God. Okay? I think that's actually important enough that I'm just going to say it again and let it sink in. Okay? Love is not a gift. Love is a fruit that God produces in our lives through his Spirit. Okay? And that means that the love that we have for one another, if it is produced by God, the degree to which we have a love for one another is the degree to which we are letting God have his way in our lives. Right? You don't get the fruit of the Spirit if you are not walking with the Spirit. We do not have love for one another unless we are walking with God in relationship with him so that he may produce that fruit in us and among us. Paul goes on. Love never ends, he says in verse 8. But as for prophecies, they will come to an end. As for tongues, they will cease. As for words of knowledge, they too will come to an end. For we know only in part, we prophesy only in part. But when the complete comes, the partial will come to an end. When I was a child, I spoke like a child and I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child, but when I became an adult, I put an end to childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we will see face to face. Now I know only in part. Then I will know fully, even as I am fully known. And now, faith, hope, and love, these three, they abide. But the greatest of these is love. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this passage. I just want to point out that the overarching point of this passage is that all of those gifts that the church is obsessing about are going to fade. When Jesus comes and he brings the renewal of all things from heaven to earth, Jesus will return to earth. He's going to renew and restore this place. And when that happens, those gifts will no longer be useful. You're not going to need a pastor to come up and teach. You're not going to need someone who can speak in tongues. You're not going to need someone who can prophesy. Paul's point is that all of those gifts have a shelf life. But what is going to remain is the people in this room and the love that we have for one another. That's Paul's point. This stuff remains. This stuff will endure. Love endures because we will endure, and we need to be growing in that love for one another. So that old song, they'll know we are Christians by our love, right? That's what needs to be increasingly true among us here in our own lives. I'm actually reticent to say too much more about this passage, partly because it's such a beautiful passage that when you try to explain or analyze it too much, it's like explaining a poem. It starts to lose some of the beauty and some of its effect. But what I'd like to do instead is to leave you with a different picture. We started with that ugly picture of what the church might look like as a metaphor. What I'd like to leave you with is another picture of what it might look like for us to live this out as a church. The story is by a guy named Addison Leach. I'm going to embellish it slightly. Addison Leach tells the story of living in Pittsburgh and teaching at the local seminary. He used to walk to and from work every day, and he lived next to an empty lot where the kids used to play baseball, and they'd shoot cans with their BB guns. One day, the neighborhood kid, David, along with some of his friends, were shooting cans when David decided that instead of shooting a can, he was going to aim for a bird he saw further off. Well, David missed that bird, and he hit Addison Leach's front window, and he shattered their giant picture window. And as soon as Addison saw this, he ran out and he chased after David, but they all scattered and went to their own houses. And David ran into his house, and he ran up to his room, and he sat on his bed, and he waited for judgment to fall. He knew this was the end as soon as he heard footsteps coming up the stairs, but nothing happened. So dinner time came around, and he sat poking at his food, but he didn't eat, and his parents were asking what was wrong, and he wouldn't say anything, but nothing happened. The next day, David was back out in the lot. He was playing with his friends again. They were playing baseball. All of a sudden, he sees Addison walking home from work after a long day's work, and he's carrying his briefcase. Well, David drops his baseball and his bat, and he runs to his house as fast as he can to get away from the enemy. He goes up to his room again, and he sits on his bed, and he waits for judgment to fall, and nothing happens. This pattern goes on for 10 days, running every time that he sees Addison coming. But after 10 days, when no judgment has happened, David starts to get a little bit careless. And he's back out in the lot or on the street, and he's playing ball with his neighborhood friends again. And he doesn't notice the time, and he doesn't notice who's behind him. And Addison comes up to him, and he says, "Hi, David." And David turns around, and he sees the enemy, and he takes off as fast as he can. So what does Addison do? He drops his briefcase, and he runs after David as fast as he can, and he catches him. And he says, "David, we can't go on like this anymore. Every time you see me, you run. You can't spend any time with your friends anymore. You can't come outside whenever I'm outside. We can't go on like this anymore." He says, "I want you to know what I've done." He says, "David, I've called the glass company. They've come, and they have repaired the window. And now you know what I want you to do, David? I want you to shake my hand and be my friend." And David looks at him, and he says, "No!" as kids do. And Addison repeats it. He says, "David, we can't go on living like this. You need to play outside with your friends. We are neighbors. We do this stuff together. The window is taken care of. The price has been paid. I want you to be my friend." And very reluctantly, David reaches out his hand, and he shakes Addison's hand. And Addison said that that was when the miracle took place. He said from that day on, he could not get rid of David. When Addison would come home from work at the end of the day, he'd be carrying his briefcase, and David would see him, and he'd drop his baseball and his glove, and he would run, and he would take Addison's briefcase, and he would carry it home with him because he was his friend. That is a picture of love. Love that is willing to be wronged and to put it aside. because that relationship is more important. Because life in the neighborhood is more important. Love will chase down another person.